For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, lawmakers could be facing a long weekend as they try to find money to fill a nearly $900 million shortfall, a bill to increase taxes on cigarettes and gas, and reduce the time new wells are taxed at a reduced rate failed on Tuesday, forcing new talks between Republicans and Democrats at the Capitol. Neva, what's going on here?
Well, more of the same. I think the only difference this week is that finally, for the first time, we have the House Minority Leader, Scott Inman, in the mix at the table in some of these discussions with the governor and with the Republican leadership. So at least we're getting to a point where it's clear it's going to take Democrats in the House along with a significant number of Republicans to be able to get something done. I mean, both caucuses, House Democrats and Republicans, have folks that are just intractable, that are not going to come to the table for any reason. And so as a result of that, I think the stark reality has finally set in that it's going to have to be a bipartisan vote to get something done. And then on the Senate side, there's still a lot of questions, even among Senate Republicans, where you have these 12 freshman senators who clearly have some different points of view on kind of this whole process, even though it's their first time through it. So it's going to be fascinating to see whether we have a weekend long up and down the hall session or not. I think remains to be seen. We'll just have to watch.
Lawmakers say they will possibly work Friday, Saturday, and even Sunday, which is just amazing.
Well, they'll wish they'd passed the legislation to allow us to buy liquor on Sundays, if that's the case. Yeah, it'll be a long weekend for legislators, an even longer fiscal year, though, for Oklahomans if we can't get a budget done. Because, we're looking here, any of the budget plans that are currently in front of the legislature for consideration include hundreds of millions of dollars of cuts to state services. We haven't seen any sort of a budget plan or a budget proposal that would get us to the point where we're not going to see dramatic cuts in state services. And that's really just a result of the inability and the lack of desire on behalf of the party of Trump to bring forward a plan that would raise enough revenue this fiscal year. I mean, there's talk now, Republicans and the governor, Republicans in the legislature and the governor have been saying, well, we're putting a gross production tax compromise on the table. Well, what that would do is it would raise rates on new wells, and even so, it would only raise it, a very small increase. That would put $0, not even a single penny, into the next revenue for the next year. So we're not getting anywhere on gross production tax. If we're going to have any sort of a budget that bridges this gap, that gets us even anywhere close to mitigating the severity of these cuts, we have to have that on the table. Leader Inman and Leader Scott Inman, the minority leader in the House, he's put forward a plan now that would not go to the historic rate of 7%, but would go to 5%, would bring in around $200 million on top of what we're at. Again, still cuts, but they wouldn't be nearly as severe.
Well, and I think here's the issue. I mean, it is about both parties and many folks in these leadership positions, I mean, at a place where everyone doesn't want to budge. And I think where we're at now, coming into Friday, Saturday, Sunday, the deadline to be able to get something done without being called into special session as a reality, we have a situation where in the House there have been some conversations that don't have these what would be called draconian cuts the way you're describing, Ryan. I mean, where you would fill the hole with perhaps 50% revenue, 50% rainy day and one-time funds, and maybe as low as a 2% cut. And if you do something like that, there's even been conversations about being able to have the $1,000 teacher pay raise as part of that, which is, again, when we start talking about all of these pieces, there are people that are absolutely, they want gross production, absolutely want teacher pay raise, absolutely want no tax cuts in other areas, the lateral question, all of these different components. But at the end of all of this process, there's got to be compromise. And I think that's where the governor has got to really get these folks in a room and say, no one really wants to live with this deal, but we've got to have a deal.
I've got to ask you, because it took the makeup of the House has not really changed all that much since the beginning. What took the Republicans so long to realize that they were going to need Democratic votes to get this passed?
I think they probably, I don't know that it's a new reality. I think it's a question of all parties or both parties really being somewhat unwilling to come to the table and really talk serious negotiations and serious compromise. I mean, we can talk about whether it's the Speaker or whether it's the Minority Leader or whether it's the pro tem. The governor's made it clear what her position is on some of this, that, you know, some things that are deal breakers for her that she'll veto if it doesn't come across her desk in the way she believes it should. So, you know, it's a process that's not new, but it is, as we reach this crescendo of a deadline and the reality of we either get it done or we go into special session, I think that it sets up for two things. One, they will get something done. But two, it just in some measure sets up for an even starker reality of what they have to look forward to next year when it's an election year.
Well, every year ahead. We hear the idea that we need to change the way the budget system is done in the first place. Do you think something like this might actually wake lawmakers up that something has to change in the way the budget is formed at the Capitol?
Well, the way that we pay for our state services. I mean, you know, that's the real issue here is are we going to have a process that allows us to raise sufficient revenue to pay for the state services that the people of Oklahoma expect? You know, this is, I don't know how many years in a row now that if we do get something done, we're going to see a budget at the last minute. Lawmakers are going to have hours to look at this budget. That's really not a way to do this. This is the most important thing that the legislature does. If they don't do anything else for an entire legislative session, this is it. And if this is your priority and year after year you run it up to the clock and barely get something done, that's not a good way to do it. You know, Neva was talking about, and I want to go back to this, and that's the lack of folks willing to budge. And I think it's important to think about why people aren't willing to budge and what they're not budging on. The Democrats in the House in particular have said, listen, we will budge on a fuel tax. We will budge on a cigarette tax. But we want some movement on a modest income tax increase for the wealthiest Oklahomans and some movement on increased gross production tax. What they're saying is the reason they won't budge off of those negotiating items is that if we're going to raise revenue, we can't disproportionately do it on the backs of lower and middle income Oklahomans. What the Republicans are saying is that they won't even put that gross production tax out there. They won't even put that income tax vote out there for consideration, because if you do that, I think you're going to get some Republicans, you're going to get a lot of Democrats, and you may be able to pass it, but they won't even put them out there because they've taken this partisan position that it's their political interest to protect the oil and gas community and protect the wealthiest Oklahomans from increased taxes. That is a terrible way to run the state government.
But they did have a bill that came close to that, and the Democrats this week decided that they would lock up and not come across and help Republicans who could not get more than whatever the 51 or whatever the number was of votes on that particular bill. And I think that's where it's at. Whether the Republicans in the House, whether that number's 51 or 55, 56, whatever it is that they can come to the table with, and probably no more than that on a bill that has all of these elements, they have to have the Democrats. And the Democrats can't just say, okay, you know, we want to keep moving the line or setting the bar higher. And that seemed to be what was occurring a little bit this week. I mean, they got a lot of what they have been talking about into the mix and on the table, and yet when push came to shove, they didn't come through with the votes.
I did the math, though, and they got 51 votes. Republicans got 51 votes, which was two-thirds of their caucus. Well, if two-thirds of the Democrats had voted, that would have been 20. So that would still just be 71. So, I mean, you've really got to do a little bit more work if you're looking at getting 76. Because, of course, obviously you can't tell any more than you could tell all the Republicans.
That's true, because it's pretty clear that they can't get the 26 Democrats to come across.
Everyone's voting their conscience.
Yeah. And that compromise bill that we're talking about doesn't include a gross production tax increase. It includes a 1% increase for new wells drilled after July 1 or later. So that doesn't do anything for the budget crisis. I mean, you throw this one little deal out there to Democrats, and you're talking about wells after they've reached peak production. So the amount of money that that would even bring in future fiscal years is, you know, minuscule compared to the potential of $350 million. If we go back to the historic rate of 70%, around $200 million, which is the House Democrats' proposal of 5%. But you have to do it on existing wells. And if you don't do that, then we're not even dealing with this year's budget. I mean, we can have that conversation next year, but it does nothing to mitigate the cuts.
And it's true in each of these areas. I mean, if we're talking about the cigarette tax, I mean, is it $1.50? Is it 75 cents? I mean, we're into the brokering now, and I think that's where the contentiousness has really kind of gone to. Many people see it as probably as bad as it's ever been out there. But the bottom line is they have a deadline, and they have to come up with a way to figure out how to deal with this budget hole and create a budget that everyone can live with. And you know, and again, no one's going to go away happy. And I think once everyone reconciles themselves to that, maybe there's some opportunity to move forward, and maybe the governor can get something she can actually be able to sign.
And a reminder, we are recording this on Thursday morning, so everything could change in the next 5 minutes. So right before the vote on the revenue increase Tuesday night, the House swore in its newest member, Republican Zach Taylor. Ryan, the representative from your old district, had about 1 second to breathe before having to participate in one of the biggest votes so far this year.
One of the biggest votes that any lawmaker could ever take. And, you know, Representative Taylor said that he voted no because he hadn't had a chance to really study the bill. You know, let's look at the dynamics here of what's happened. You know, you look at House District 28 and where they have gone in terms of representation. You had Tom Newell, who voted against their interest and then left right after the election, left them without any representation this legislative session. You get to a point now where they finally elect somebody, put somebody back in, and then they say, well, I haven't read the bill yet, so I'm just going to vote no. You know, I have a little bit of empathy for Representative Taylor because I know that it's difficult to get your sea legs at the Capitol. But you know what? There's not a firewall on the internet at the House. He could have been reading these bills. He could have reached out to the caucus. He was a member-elect. The idea that he just walked in and was all of a sudden handed the stack of papers and, oh, read this in 5 seconds or vote no, that's ridiculous. You know, so that's a little bit of a lame excuse, and I hope the folks in District 28 see through that.
And I don't know that it was really an excuse. I mean, when you look at the platform that he ran on, I mean, it was very clear. Even Tom Coburn, who endorsed him, said, look, here's a guy who is someone who's not going to go up there and tax us, you know, find ways to just tax their way out of the budget shortfall, but someone that was a small businessman who favored fiscal discipline. So he campaigned at the doors on that. He said he, you know, that was kind of his philosophy coming to the Capitol. So it was no surprise to anyone that he was going to make a no vote on a bill such as this one. It just happened to be the first one a few hours after he had actually been sworn into office.
Certainly didn't want to vote on a tax increase, but he didn't necessarily want to say that he went against his caucus. I think it was probably the best political answer he could probably give.
Well, and that's just it, is that, you know, in a time when we need, you know, champions at the legislature, we've elected another politician. I mean, he's proven himself very adept at that so far, but that's about the only thing that he's proven himself adept at.
And if the Democrat had been elected, they very quickly would have staked their ground on the opposite side of the coin. So I think this is what you say is correct, Ryan. This is politics, and these folks are coming to the Capitol knowing that they're going to turn around and be running again. And what they ran on, they've got to at least follow through, or the voters have every reason to take another look and say, is this who we really thought we elected?
Right. Well, Taylor running for re-election.
He won with a very slim majority of the vote, or a little over 50 votes won that race for him. And the cuts that are going to likely happen, if we have any sort of cuts coming out of this budget, are going to hit rural Oklahoma the hardest. And so going back to Seminole County and Pottawatomie County, Lincoln County, and talking to the folks there and saying, you know, this is how I'm going to justify these cuts on your back, that's going to be not an enjoyable
although
campaign
what he
experience.
Was saying he heard for months on the doorstep was that this is where the folks were, that they wanted some real fiscal restraint. And so whether he was hearing correctly what the voters in that district want or not, I mean, time will tell as he goes through the rest of this session and back out on the campaign trail.
A common practice known as the American rule says that for the most part, parties in a lawsuit are responsible for their own legal fees. But controversial state Senator Anthony Sykes slipped an amendment into a popular bill killing the American rule and forcing losing parties to pay the legal fees of the winners. Neva, how did no one notice this?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, this loser pays deal is something that it's the classic deal. Everyone, this bill goes through. The governor signs it, and then all of a sudden everybody goes, oops, we didn't notice that this is really what was in there. So some people say that there'll be some efforts to try to correct this before the end of the session. I think, you know, given the timeline that we're on, that would seem doubtful, but clearly there are problems here, and this will be something that no doubt will be revisited.
This was really brought to life by Non-Doc, an online journalism website, and really the way that Trace Savage wrote it was talking about the lack of lawyers in the state capitol. Do you think something like that is actually becoming detrimental to the capitol?
Well, a couple of things have happened. We have fewer lawyers in the legislature than probably ever before. And, you know, I think that there's a sense that all we have are at the capitol are lawyers and oilmen, and that's just not the case at all. You know, we certainly have a lack of people that are accustomed to reading statutes and reading them in a way that says, this is what this means. You have to rely on staff, and staff does a good job. But things like this can get by if you don't have some studied and trained eyes that are actually casting votes, looking at these pieces of legislation. This is something that folks have been trying to do for a very long time. And so the one reason is a lack of lawyers. The second is that with tort reform and the tort reform political warfare that occurred over the last decade, that was really a political effort on behalf of big business and insurance companies. They wanted to enrich their bottom line, but there was a partisan reason for that as well, and that was to undermine the ability of the trial lawyers lobby to be able to show up at the Capitol and influence legislation and influence elections. And that's happened. You've seen a real retreat from the trial lawyer lobby from where it used to be. I mean, they're still out there, they're still active, they still have some influence, but they're nowhere near where they used to be. This is something where the Trial Lawyers Association, probably, you know, 5-10 years ago, this would have been the poison pill amendment that they put all of their resources against. And now these things just can just slide by. I mean, they've got some great representation out there, but there's just too much to keep up with. Senator Sykes knew exactly what he was doing when he put this in there. This has been part of tort reform legislation that we've seen in the past. It's going to have a real impact on underdogs in litigation. My hope is that if they don't get something done now, that if the governor does call the legislature back for a special session, that she can add this to the charge of the special session, because what the American rule does is it says that everybody walks into litigation on a somewhat level playing field. Now, this creates a huge disincentive for somebody to sue a big corporation. Big corporation has in-house counsel. They can hire the most expensive lawyers in the state or in the country. And then if you lose, you know, the prospect of losing. And just because you might lose doesn't mean that a case is frivolous. That's why you go to court. You've got a dispute, and you want to go get it resolved. But if you lose, you have this huge bill put on top of you and could bankrupt you. And so that's a huge disincentive to holding people accountable in our civil justice system. I think it may be unconstitutional as a violation of our state's constitution's guarantee to the access to the courts.
And I would agree that that's something I've heard around the Capitol, is that there is some issue about that. There is a constitutional question clearly on this. So.
Sykes is reportedly thrilled that this thing got passed and that no one noticed. Do you think this also might have to do with term limits? You've only got people that have been in there for such a short amount of time. You get used to reading legislation when you've been there for 20 years.
That's right, and you have someone that is being term limited. In question in this particular discussion. So you're right. I mean, it oftentimes does fall back to this kind of ongoing question of the impact that term limits is really having on the legislative process.
The state Supreme Court rejects a challenge to a new law which makes changes to the earned income tax credit. Opponents argued the measure was a revenue bill which should have started in the House rather than the Senate, but justices disagreed. Ryan, what do you think about this judgment?
Well, I mean, if you look at the order, it's just an order. I mean, there's really no legal analysis there. We don't know what went into the court's thinking in terms of, you know, how they looked at this and said, this is a revenue bill, this is not a revenue bill. And so that's something I think that lawmakers in particular right now, whenever, you know, they're trying to, you know, put together this budget and they're wondering, do we have to get to the supermajority requirement? Do we have to start something in the House? There have been some questions this year about proposals and whether or not they would amount to a revenue bill. And so there's really no guidance here from the court. I think that what the court has said is, you know, they're not going to wade into this deal unless, you know, they're probably not going to wade in unless it's a clear-cut revenue bill that violated the rules, and they're going to give some deference to the legislature. You know, this is really a legal challenge to, you know, Senate Bill 1604 that put this in place, which was a real assault. It was, you know, again, we talk about balancing the budget on the backs of low and middle income Oklahomans. You know, this cut the earned income tax benefit by $28.1 million, nearly 75%. And, you know, this goes to Oklahomans, working families, and some single working parents out there as a way to help combat poverty. It's a bipartisan piece of policy that started in Governor Keating's administration, and it was really gutted last year. And so this litigation was an effort to you know, strike back against something that they were unable to defeat in the legislature.
Neva.
Well, I think it's clear. I mean, not only was it close, I mean, a 5-4 decision, I mean, right. Certainly, I mean, the court was very, very divided on this. But Ryan is right. I mean, when you look at nearly 2/3 of Oklahoma families are in a place where they can receive this earned income tax credit, that really does affect. I mean, it affects a lot of folks that are just at a place where they're in low-wage jobs. This has some significant impact to them. So I think it's one of these issues that clearly, I think you're right, Ryan. I mean, the court punted it because it's a very murky water that all of this legislation has really been in, and I think, you know, and the arguments have been wide on it. I mean, the Attorney General's argument on it versus the counter arguments. I think this is something that we'll see revisited once again. I think, you know, the more we have these types of bills with no real closure, no real impact in terms of this is the way it's going to be moving forward, but we continue to have to revisit and revisit and revisit, it just mires up the process even more.
Finally, I do want to ask you, because it came out this morning, that this again Thursday morning, that Frank Keating might be on a short list to be the FBI. Have your thoughts, Neva?
Well, I guess you know, the governor said he didn't expect that he would get that position, but clearly, I mean, he's someone with his background as they're looking for a wide kind of pool of applicants. Given his background both in Washington and as a governor of a state, it's not a surprise to see his name on the list. I think he we'll just have to see where it goes from here.
Ryan,
yeah, I think it's unsurprising. I was kind of surprised not to see his name in the original list that were floating around. Mm-hmm. Now, I do think that there is some question as to whether or not he meets this standard that you know, some Senate Republicans and I think all Senate Democrats have put forward, and that is, we don't want a political figure. We want somebody from the law enforcement community.
Even Tom Cole himself
is saying that this is what we need. You know, Frank Keating has a background with the FBI, but he's a political figure. He's been a governor of the state. He's been a lobbyist in Washington for quite a while. I don't know. I think that he may have stepped back in some regard from that role, but he is a distinctly political figure. And now, he was a Republican governor, I think, in a time and era where a lot of Democrats look back at that and say, oh, man. Man, that's we could live with that, but it's still this idea that the people of the United States and their representatives in the United States Senate, I think, need to have confidence in this next director and to know that they will be beyond political reproach. That's not to say that Frank Keating has any political motivations there. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that the appearance of politicizing this upcoming investigation by the FBI has to be something that's avoided at all costs.
And I think even with that in mind, I think that when you look at Frank Keating's career of public service, he had a stellar career both at the federal level and in state government, and he's someone that certainly, I think, deserves serious attention and consideration in this process.
And certainly they are thinking about it. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.